This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 26, Highlights from the Sigmund H. Horn Archaeological Museum.
Welcome to the Horn Archaeological Museum in Berrien Springs, Michigan, on the campus of Andrews University, and I want to demonstrate and show this important artifact that we have on display. This is actually a model of Jerusalem, and this model is well over 100 years old. We're estimating a date of around 1880 that this plaster model was constructed. Now, why was it constructed? During this time, the 19th century, travel to the Holy Land was an endeavor practiced by the very rich and the very adventurous. It's very dangerous and very expensive and arduous journey, and oftentimes resulted in injury or death, either from violence or illness. So going to the Holy Land in some ways was almost as difficult as going to the moon today. More than that, early in the 19th century and before, there was no photographs to look at to get an idea of what the terrain and places looked like. So the advent of photography, say starting in the 1850s, helped that tremendously. But still, to be able to see the lay of the land and to understand the city of Jerusalem as a whole, you needed something like this. And so a certain amount of these models, there couldn't have been too many, were constructed, and these would be exhibited at symposiums and state fairs and large events, public events, and people would get to see what Jerusalem looked like during that time. I pointed out that our best guess is that this was constructed sometime around 1880, sometime in the 1880s, perhaps in that decade, because landmarks of Jerusalem that were built in the 1890s and later are not visible on this model. So that helps us date it more concisely to a narrow span of time. So let's walk around and look at what this model tells us. Now, it's important even today to have a model like this showing Jerusalem 150 years ago, because it shows us the topography of the city, around the city, the lay of the land. And that's important because today all of this is built up. The old city itself is more or less, I would say, 80% or 90% still there, but outside of the city, everything's changed. So let's look from my left to my right and point out some of the geographical and topographical features. Right at the very edge of the model is the summit of the Mount of Olives, and the Mount of Olives actually is a ridge extending from the site of what is now Hebrew University, Mount Scopus, Har HaTzofit, and French Hill, and then it goes, there's a slight ravine there, and then it goes on a ridge all the way to a break in the ridge between the Mount of Olives and the Mount of Offense, which is just, at the far edge of the model. By the way, this complex here on the top of the Mount of Olives is actually the Church of the Ascension, initiated and built by Queen Helena in the 4th century, commemorating the ascension of Jesus from the top of the Mount of Olives. Over to the far center of the model is the incline from the Hinnom Valley, and that continues to go off of the map or off of the model to the Hill of Evil Counsel, as it's called today, the southern ridge that borders the southern horizon of Jerusalem. Over to this side of the map, you've got the beginnings of the Watershed Hill over here, which is, again, unfortunately not included in the model. And then in front of me immediately here is high ground that continues to rise from the north side of the city. So again, to get our bearings, this is east, north, west, and south. Now, as far as the valleys, we have here the Kidron Valley that begins in this area here and then continues to down the eastern side of the city of Jerusalem, continues down past this southeastern hill, which we'll talk about as the city of David, and then continues down all the way into the Judean wilderness and empties out the Dead Sea. There is a valley that's very difficult to discern. A little bit of it here that you can see is called the Tyropian or Central Valley, and the Valley of the Cheesemakers in Josephus. And this separated the southeastern hill from the western hill, and it originated up by perhaps Damascus Gate, which is here. Most of it's been filled in. And I point out, too, that all these valleys were much deeper in antiquity. Again, thousands of years of use, and debris building up has lifted the surface of these valleys. The other valley I want to point out, which begins up here, is the Valley of Hinnom, or the Gai ben Hinnom, Valley of the Sons of the Hinnom, which meanders down along the western side of the city, curves to the east, and unites with the Kidron and the Tyropian Valley, and then empties out into the Judean wilderness. So these are the valleys around Jerusalem. And as you can see by looking at this, Jerusalem was fairly well defended on the east side, west side, and south side. However, the north side, you don't have any valley to act as some sort of a moat or trench. And this is where Jerusalem was most vulnerable. And most of the successful attacks in history against Jerusalem came from the north. All right, so some important sites outside of the old city of Jerusalem as it exists in 1880 and still exists today are some sites in the Kidron Valley. We have the future site of the Church of All Nations, which is a site of the Garden of Gethsemane in this general vicinity here. All right, and notice too that the immense cemetery that covers the Mount of Olives today, you do not see anything that is a later development, though the Mount of Olives served as one of Jerusalem's cemeteries from the time of the second millennium BC and probably earlier. There's been tombs found at Dominus Flavit dating back to the late Bronze Age, again, the time of the Exodus, or perhaps even earlier. Now, the Hill of Offense is here, and below that Hill of Offense, on this slope, is the Arab village of Silwan, and this is biblical Shiloah, and again, served as a cemetery, actually, during the Old Testament period, including the tomb of Pharaoh's daughter, and other important, the tomb of the royal steward, and other tombs that have been discovered and mapped and published, and this, again, looks across to the southeastern hill, and it is here that the oldest part of Jerusalem, the original settlement of Jerusalem, was established. And it was established here not because of topographical considerations. It was established here because of the Gihon Spring, which is in this area right here. And that was the water source, the only water source for much of Jerusalem's history, and continues to gush water today. And so the early settlements were here, back to the Chalcolithic period and early Bronze period. They have found a house, excavated a house in the city of David that dates to the early Bronze period, again, before 2000 BC, so very early. And recent excavations, say in the last 100 years, but even more recently by several Israeli scholars and archaeologists, have uncovered a lot of information from this area, including walls from the Old Testament period, specifically the time of 8th century and 7th century walls, defensive walls, as well as the later wall that Nehemiah built when the returnees from at that time Persia began to rebuild the defenses of Jerusalem. Over here, across the Tyropian Valley, is the Western Hill. And this is erroneously called Mount Zion today. The real Mount Zion is the Temple Mount, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But this Western Hill in antiquity was part of the walled city. And this city, or the wall here that we see in the old city and exists today, dates back to 1517. And part of that is built upon older walls, but part of it is not. And most of the walls of Jerusalem from the last 2 centuries of the Old Testament until the Muslim conquest included this important high ground here called, erroneously called Mount Zion, actually should be called the Western Hill. But there's a lot of important history on the Western Hill, one of which is the Tomb of David here, also the site of the Upper Room. And in the 1970s, the House of Caiaphas was discovered in this immediate vicinity. Again, an alternative site to the Church of St. Peter at Gallicantu, which is down on the eastern slope of Mount Zion, Western Hill. But also towers and sections of wall have been found along this route from excavations from the 19th century and more modern times. And these walls date all the way back, again, to Old Testament during the period of the monarchy, say early 8th century B.C. Okay, we come over here. And we have a large pool here that still exists today. And that dates again to the New Testament period. And then we have another large pool here called Birkat Sultan, used primarily during the Ottoman period, but certainly could be much earlier than that. And you see here on the models some early Jewish settlements, such as Mishkanot Sha'ananim and Yemen Moshe, the neighborhood of Yemen Moshe, which is Moses Montefiore built a windmill to help grind grain of the farmers there in the 19th century. This is one of the few first communities or settlements built outside the walls of Jerusalem in the 19th century. The Russian Quarter, again, used for Russian pilgrims to come when they visit Jerusalem to stay. And still not too many buildings, as you can see, built outside the wall. Jerusalem at this time in 1880 was under the Ottoman Turkish rule, and again, the walls still were needed for protection at night from marauding bands of thieves and bandits. So looking at the wall here itself, I'll try to point out some of the sections of the wall that are actually older. This is called the Citadel, or the Tower of David. And one of these towers here, this one that I'm pointing my finger to, is actually one of the three towers erected by Herod and his Hasmonean predecessors. And they were named Mariamne, Hippicus, and Phazael. We don't know which one of these remains here, but just the base of the one tower can still be seen today. And it was rebuilt later with different masonry, but the lower courses of it are clearly Herodian. And these were built at a very strategic location because this location was the corner of what Josephus called the first wall. And it also was a weak part of Jerusalem's defenses because, again, the topography slopes down towards it. So it was heavily fortified. And the wall, the first wall, actually ran from the citadel down along the slope of the Hinnom Valley, surrounding the western hill, down, and then surrounding the southeastern hill up to the Temple Mount, the trapezoid-shaped platform there, and then straight across there up what was called the Transversal Valley, which ran this way, and that wall was on the south side of that Transversal Valley back up to the citadel. That wall was originally completed in the 8th century B.C. and then rebuilt probably in the late 2nd or early 1st century B.C. by the Hasmoneans and then used by Herod and the Byzantines and so on until it was destroyed and never rebuilt, or most of it was never rebuilt. Certainly the part that goes around the Western Hill and the Southeastern Hill, again called the City of David. So Right in this general vicinity here with the Herod's three towers was the palace of Herod the Great, which is now the Armenian Quarter. And that palace was excavated in the 1960s, unfortunately very, very poorly preserved, only in the basement levels, you would say. But this is, again, the site of Herod's palace. Now, recently there's been some debate on the place where Pilate presented Jesus to the population, Ecce Homo, behold the man. And for centuries, that was thought to have occurred over in this area here, next to the, just on the corner, this area here along the Via Dolorosa, the corner of the Temple Mount. But this event could have also have happened here outside of Herod's palace. Jesus would be presented outside the walls through a gate here on a platform to the population of Jerusalem, standing below on the Hinnom Valley. So that's in the Hinnom Valley. That is a alternative to the traditional site near the Via Dolorosa. Okay, moving ahead here, we have, I'll explain kind of the city as a whole and then we'll take it apart. The city as it exists here in this model and exists today had four quarters, Revaim in Hebrew, and the first quarter I want to point out was the Armenian Quarter, which is basically from Zion Gate over here and then to Jaffa Gate, kind of a square-shaped quarter. And that was, and still is today, the Armenian Quarter, Christian Quarter. The regular Christian Quarter, simply put, was met up with the Armenian Quarter and came up here in this area here. And that Christian Quarter also contains the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest site in Christendom, which covers both the place of crucifixion and the place of burial for Jesus Christ. And then we have a large area here, including the Temple Mount, which is considered the Muslim Quarter. And that continues from roughly Damascus Gate over here past Herod's Gate, and including the Temple Mount, which is called Haram al-Sharif, the Arabic name for the Temple Mount. And finally, we're left with the Jewish Quarter, which comes up to the Temple Mount here, which is now the Western Wall, and meets the Armenian Quarter right in this area here. So this is this area here. This is the Hurva Synagogue. One of these is the Hurva Synagogue. I don't recall which one it is. One of those two domes. And notice here the Mugrabi Quarter here has been completely removed, and that allows access to the western wall of the temple platform, the Temple Mount, which of course is the western wall, HaKotel, where Jews go and pray. It's the holiest site in Judaism as we speak. So some changes there. Some clearance of all these buildings, and I might add, between 1948 and 1967, the Jewish Quarter was destroyed by the Jordanians. So after Israel reclaimed the old city in 1967, they rebuilt the entire Jewish Quarter. So it's by virtue of its newness, it's the nicest part of the old city, the most the newest part, the newest buildings built in the old city. So let's talk a little bit about the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount here is a platform, again trapezoid-shaped, that was constructed or in its final form by Herod the Great. And Herod the Great, nothing stopped Herod the Great's need to expand and to build a larger place to hold larger numbers of worshipers. He actually built this eastern, or I should say western, side of the platform over the central or Tyropian Valley. So the old Tyropian Valley actually ran under this, and he just expanded it and built right over it, and then filled that in with the massive amounts of fill to make a nice flat platform for worshipers coming to worship at the temple. In the center of this platform is the Muslim shrine, the Dome of the Rock, which is the third holiest site in Islam, and supposedly shows the hoof prints of Muhammad's horse, Barak, as it leapt up into heaven. And it's not mentioned, Jerusalem, by the way, is not mentioned in the Quran at all. This is in the later hadith, but still it's considered the third holiest site in Islam. And the exposed bedrock there, as I mentioned in my lectures, show foundational cuts of Solomon's temple. And, of course, after that, the second temple as well. And Lean Rittmeyer, who has studied this extensively over many years, has shown conclusively that this is where the temple was. So the location of the Jewish temples, both Solomon's temple and the later second temple, Zerubbabel, and again remodeled by Herod, is right underneath the Dome of the Rock. The other building here is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that is a very ancient Muslim mosque that once had wings on either side going out both east and west, and that's been shrunk down. But again, a very ancient, one of the first Muslim mosques, certainly in Jerusalem, and again remains a very important place today for worship every Friday. So this would have been the site, going back to New Testament Second Temple times, this would have been the royal stoa here, where Herod and guests could view the sacrifices and worship at the temple, and all of this would have been colonnaded. And of course, some of those columns and column capitals and bases still exist, just can't not in situ, but this would have been a very, very beautiful place. And then the gateway to the outside of the city here was a golden gate, and that still exists. It's walled up, but that, again, is the site of the temple and the temple precinct, the temple itself, and, of course, the Holy of Holies. Now, the Roman fortress Antonia has been completely eradicated. There's bedrock cut away in this area here that you can see where the bedrock that it was built upon. But the actual fortress is completely gone. And of course, this is a site of Ecce Homo with the later arch, not dating to the time of Christ, but dating to the second century, probably erected by Hadrian, that commemorates Pilate presenting Jesus to the people, assumingly he was here at the Fortress Antonia. Again, the alternate view is that this was done in Herod's palace. That would have been traditionally done in this area. The Church of St. Anne here is a Crusader period church that's in beautiful state of preservation, and that commemorates the family of Jesus, but also it's located very close to the pools of Bethesda, which were excavated shortly after this time by the White Fathers, and poorly excavated, but exposed. And that was at five portico twin pools where the blind man or the lame man was healed by Jesus. The gateway here is Herod's Gate or Flower Gate that still is used. And then Damascus Gate, which is the main gate to the north. And again, these gates oftentimes are named after roads that come out of them, and that's the destination. The destination is the road to Damascus. The Jaffa Gate, again, the road to Jaffa to the west. Zion Gate, again, referring to Mount Zion. And then the Dung Gate down here, which was where the refuge, the garbage of the city was hauled out. Now, after this model was made, there was another gate that was made into the city, the New Gate, which allowed people to gain access to the Christian quarter much more quickly than going through the Damascus or Jaffa Gate. And even later, in the last 20 years or so, there's been the Dung Gate has been enlarged and another pedestrian gate opened up nearby. So that is the modern gates of Jerusalem. The biblical gates of Jerusalem are much more complicated. First mentioned as a whole in Nehemiah chapter 3, but also in rabbinical sources, and none of those have been actually identified except for one over along the Ophel. So, again, some other high points. This is the Austrian hospice here along the road coming down from Damascus Gate, clearly already built by 1880. Other than that, these are, again, buildings that generally date from the Mamluk period and the Ottoman period, and not too much before. These were oftentimes rebuilt on earlier remains, but what you see here is generally Mamluk and Ottoman in date. This is, again, a very useful tool for understanding what Jerusalem looked like in the 19th century, understanding the topography around Jerusalem, and also being able to point out some biblical sites in their context at that time. So thank you for listening and for enjoying this model as we do here at Andrews University. Welcome to the Horn Museum again. And I have before me here what's called the Black Obelisk. And this is a copy of the original, which we had commissioned from the British Museum. And they made an exact copy of the original, which again is in their possession. This is a nearly 7 foot tall stela, or obelisk, as you'd so to speak, with a step pyramid at the top, with cuneiform writing in between all these registers and along the top. Now, this was found in 1846 when Henry Austin Layard, British adventurer and archaeologist, excavated the site of Nimrud, Neo-Assyrian Nimrud, which is also known as Kala. And he found this, and lo and behold, cuneiform had just recently been deciphered, and this was translated, this text was translated, and it was found out to be a monument that was erected by Shalmaneser III sometime in the 820, around the 820 date B.C. And it commemorates his 841 B.C., campaign to the Levant, and Shalmaneser III camped out upon Mount Carmel in Israel and received tribute and gifts from all of the kings in the surrounding region, and that included the king of Israel. And I want to point out especially the second register here, where it shows a bearded person with a stocking cap type hat, bowing deeply before Shalmaneser III, who's holding a bowl. And this king is identified in the text below as Jehu, son of Omri, king of Israel. And even though Shalmaneser got the details wrong, Jehu, this is the first mention and certainly first physical depiction of a king of Israel from a contemporary monument. Jehu actually overthrew the Omri dynasty in a coup d'etat that same year. And when Shalmaneser appeared, he bowed and accepted the position of a vassal and gave gifts, which are described as well. So this was an incredibly important discovery, very exciting discovery, which was a sensation around Europe at that time, to find something that actually mentions and depicts a king of Israel with the king of Assyria. By the way, Shalmaneser III is probably mentioned in Hosea 11 as Shalman, who defeated and destroyed Beit Arbel and committed horrible atrocities, as typical of Assyrian kings. But it remains today one of the greatest finds in biblical archaeology, again, completely confirming a biblical text that describes Jehu and his overthrow of the Omri dynasty. Thank you very much. Welcome again to the main hall of the Horn Archaeological Museum. I have beside me a very important Old Testament monument, and this is actually called the Mesha Stela or Moabite Stela. And the original of this stela is in the Louvre Museum in Paris, and we contacted the Louvre and had them commission them to make an exact replica of the original, which we received from them and have on display here today. What is the Mesha Stela? Well, In 1868, an Anglican missionary by the name of Frederick Klein was traveling through Dabon, Jordan. This is central Jordan. It's an ancient Moabite city, ruins or a tell there. And he met with some Bedouin who showed him this monument or stela laying on the ground. And Klein immediately recognized ancient writing on the stela and recognized its significance and importance. And so he made some copies of some letters, some words, and then went back to Jerusalem and made a huge mistake. And that mistake was to telling the Prussian council about his finding and wanting to buy it. And word quickly got out, and pretty soon everybody in Jerusalem, the British, the French, and the Prussians, all wanted to get their hands on this stela. So the Bedouin were getting offers to buy this from various people, and the details are still uncertain, but somebody got the bright idea that maybe these Europeans want to buy this because there might be something valuable like gold inside. And so they heated up this stela, again made out of basalt, and got it red hot, and then poured cold water over it and shattered the entire stela into pieces. Well, a French diplomat slash archaeologist by the name of Charles Clermont Ganneau went back and bought as many of these pieces as he could from the various Bedouin families, and eventually with other pieces from other people was able to reconstruct about two-thirds of the original inscription. Thankfully, somebody had made a paper squeeze, put some paper over it and wet the paper and made an impression of the entire inscription before the Bedouin had destroyed it. Unfortunately that squeeze was in very bad condition because they had to rip it off and right away quickly because of a threat of other Bedouin coming quickly on horseback or camelback, and he had to get out of there quickly. So he stuffed the three pieces in his saddlebags and ran off. But between that, those three pieces of a paper squeeze and the surviving pieces or fragments of the stela, the text was more or less restored. Now, what does the text say? Well, the text starts out by saying, I am Mesha, the Debonite. This is, again, a person known in the Old Testament. In 2 Kings chapter 3, Mesha is a king of Moab and actually wars against Israel and Judah. And during around the second, or rather the third quarter of the 9th century, roughly during the time of Elijah and Elisha, slightly later than that. But it recounts in the Moabite language his successes in revolting against Israel. Remember in 841, which the Black Obelisk again records, another monument here that we talked about on a different segment, that Jehu overthrew the Omri dynasty. And when that happened, again, vassal kingdoms in Transjordan and elsewhere recognized a weakness, perceived weakness in the Israelite strength. And so they revolted as well. And so Mesha was able to conquer several Israelite towns and expand Moab to the north up into the Madaba Plains or the biblical Hami Shore. And these cities and towns are mentioned in the Mesha Stela and artifacts and actually the name of the divine name of Yahweh is mentioned. The hearth of David or the hearth of Yahweh is mentioned as being taken. So a lot of important biblical information relating to the biblical text and biblical history, as well as the name Gadite, the tribe of Gad again was settled there, as well as a lot of toponyms, a lot of names of cities. So the Mesha Stela remains to this day an incredibly important testimony, independent testimony of the biblical text, and it, for the most part, aligns and I would say complements the biblical account of the same war. It is the longest monumental text that's ever been found in the West Semitic dialect, which is very similar to Hebrew. Hebrew's an Israelites and Moabites could definitely converse and talk back and forth. Now, later on, much later on, in around 1994, André Lemaire, another French epigrapher, recognized House of David, one of the bottom lines of this inscription, again, partially partially preserved in the inscription. So, along with the Tel Dan stela, which mentioned House of David, Lemaire found it here in the Mesha stela as well. And there's a lot of questions remaining about this, about the text, some obscure, say, cryptic references that are mentioned by Mesha here that are still trying to be understood and interpreted. So nearly every year, new papers and new studies come out on the Mesha stela. It's that important. And again, still, scholars still glean information that enlighten us about the 9th century in the Levant from this very, very important inscription. Thank you very much.
This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 26, Highlights from the Sigmund H. Horn Archaeological Museum.